3 years ago, we raised money for a bike for a lady named Rose. 2 years ago, we raised money for a house for Emily and Chisomo. 1 year ago, we raised money to help rid an entire village of malaria. And most recently, we raised money for a girls' school in a rural Malawian village. The bike cost $60, the house $1,000, the net $9,000, and the girls' school $100,000. We went from changing one person's life with $60 to changing a generation of real people living in Malawi with $100,000. And today, we're going even bigger. My name is Gret, and I hope you'll join me in literally changing the world forever by the end of this year, 2016. We have 96 days to make this happen, and I'll explain how we're going to do it in just a minute. Right now, giving to charity is about as much fun as doing your homework. In fact, think back to the last time you gave. Chances are you received a thank you email, and that's about it. That's why, for the last 6 months, me and my team have been secretly working on an app that helps donors see the impact their money makes when they give. It's called DonorSee. There are Peace Corps workers, aid workers, and missionaries living in every corner of the globe. And all of them live around vulnerable people who could use some help meeting their basic needs. We've designed our app to make it easier than ever before to fundraise for these needs. All you have to do is add a picture, the story, the amount, and then share. But here's what we do different. Not only is it easier to post about needs, but it's also easier for donors to see what happens to their money when needs are funded. Imagine someone like Nicole posts about a boy named Wyson who needs a wheelchair. 10 people donate to that project, and afterwards, those same 10 people get a notification straight to their phone showing how their small amount of money changed the life of a boy in Malawi. DonorSee gets your money to real people in really urgent situations in real time. So now that you know what DonorSee is, let me tell you how we're going to use it to change the world. Our goal over the next 96 days is to get one funded need in every country on the planet. If you know someone living abroad who would be good at using this app, tag them in the comments of this video. We're not going to stop until we leave our footprint in every country on the planet. DonorSee. Give directly, see impact. Will you help us change the world? Here's what you can do. Number one, download DonorSee and start giving. It's really fun and addictive, I promise. Number two, tell your friends living abroad about our plan to literally change the world by the end of this year by tagging them in this video. And number three, share this video. Every time you click the share button, you create a ripple effect with endless potential. We have 96 days to make this happen. Join us.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists who think you need a government permission slip for everything? Everything you do is an A to B conversation, and the government should see their way out of it. Create true free markets by adopting the BIPCOT No Government License. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows use or modification of any product, service, or software except by governments or government agents.
Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network on theseedsofliberty.com and theconsciousresistance.com. So today I have a special guest, Gret Glier, coming in from Virginia. He's a founder of the DonorSee app for Android and iOS. The website is DonorSee.com, DonorSee.com. And you can find him on you can find that on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under DonorSee. And we're going to talk a little bit about why he developed that and his background about how he, because eventually he ended up in Malawi, amazingly enough, and he's from the United States. So how does someone from the United States end up in Malawi? Well, you know, one of the poorest countries in the world, and how that shaped his perspective on poverty and what he did about it. No, he didn't petition a congressman to pass another law to steal from more people. He actually did it himself, and he made some change, which is so awesome. So we're going to talk about that and his thoughts on the welfare state and foreign aid. So, Gret, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I heard you first on Tom Woods, and it was an amazing episode. he was the way he started the episode is like, he's like, "You're not going to believe who I have on. I'm not going to tell you. It's going to be a surprise. Don't look at the Tom Woods notes. Don't cheat. You're gonna love it though. He's like, you know how some people say, you know, this is gonna change the world? Well, what this guy is doing, I think, will change the world. And that coming from Tom Woods, that's something pretty special. So
yeah, I was very, very touched by his reaction. It was really nice.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when he sees something that is valuable, you know, you go for it. And same thing with me. You know, it's like I gather information from all different sources, and I try to find people who, you know, have something special and help them out. And you recently just released it, right? Like a month ago?
Yeah, less than a month. September 26th was our launch date. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you've been, just lazy, procrastinating at home, playing video games, watching TV.
Yeah, pretty much. Looking into the new Nintendo Switch. I can't wait for that to come back.
typical young kid.
Millennial, right?
but please get into, you know, your background, how you ended up in Malawi and developing this app.
Sure. So I usually start with I graduated in 2012 from Grove City College, which is like among libertarian circles, it's known to be like a libertarian leaning college. Mm-hmm. And I graduated in 2012 with a degree in entrepreneurship. And I spent the first year working at Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And that year working at Enterprise was one of the toughest years of my life. Because, you know, just like your first year out of college, it's just like one of those like challenging, like you're getting your feet wet in the real world. But what was interesting is I was like being promoted really quick, and I was being fast tracked, and I was told like, hey, your potential in this company to like rise to the ranks is, you know, it's, you have a lot of potential. And somehow, I was told I have all this potential. I was told, you know, it's only a matter of time before you have like a company car, 6-figure paycheck, all this like nice stuff, cushy job, like all this nice stuff. And I was hearing all these like nice things. And at the same time, I was like very, very depressed. Like, I was thinking like, I don't want to like wake up in 20 years and look back at like how I spent the last 20 years of my life and realize like, my contribution to society is I'm just like really good at renting cars. Like that was a very depressing thought for me. And, so I started looking at different like mission organizations to apply to, or different ways to get overseas. And most of them were just like not really the right fit. Like some of them rejected me, some of them accepted me, and I just didn't accept it. You know, it's just like, I couldn't really find one that was a good fit. And then one day I was at a wedding and I was a groomsman, and one of the other groomsmen was telling me that he's going to Malawi. And that's like a whole story in and of itself. One thing led to another. I ended up going, that wedding was on June 13th, and the very next month, August 13th, I was on a flight. Like I just found out about the opportunity, just met this guy and I just like knew, okay, this like fell into my lap. This is the right thing to do. So I went over to Malawi to teach math originally in a, like an international school. And, I lived there for 3 years. So as I lived there, I taught math less and I did more poverty alleviation work. And over time, I'll just quickly brush over the three things. So the first thing I did was I started a ministry that builds houses for homeless orphans and widows. And then, I started like a YouTube channel and kind of like a visual donor network that showed people how their money was being used. And we used that to build a girls' school. We raised $100,000 last year to build a girls' school for rural Malawian girls, because all this research suggests that girls' education is basically the key to poverty alleviation in most of these like third world countries. So we did that, and school opened on September 5th. So that was like a big deal. And there's 120 girls in the school right now attending. And then September 26th is when I launched this app, which kind of took the idea behind like showing people where their money goes. It took that idea and just said, all right, I've been doing this. It's obviously very effective. I personally raised $100,000 to build a girls' school. What if we put the same tools into everyone else's hands in the world, every other aid worker living overseas? And so raised about $150,000 in venture capital money and launched the app. And today we have 1,000 users, and we've had tens of thousands of dollars go through the app, and it's doing really well. I'm very, very excited about it.
So, okay. So, can you talk a little bit about the type of poverty that you witnessed when you went over there that really, inspired you to develop this?
Mm-hmm. So I think here's the story that, there was one story I told on the Tom Woods show, and this is a story that's maybe a little bit more, I don't know if graphic is the right word, but I'll share it on this podcast. It will be unique to this podcast. So, when I first got to Malawi, I met this young girl named Emily. She was a little Malawian girl. She's 5 or 6. And, this is her story. So I met her and I was told that 2 years before I met her, Emily's dad was beating Emily's mom. And Emily's mom got so sick, and she developed these sores in her legs that were so bad that she needed to go to the hospital. So I had a friend, Blessings, who was like kind of doing ministry work in that village, and he saw the situation and he said, "Okay, I gotta get this lady to a hospital." But it cost $20 to get her to a hospital, and you know, in America, that's like you find it on the ground and it's not a big deal. But in Malawi, $20 is like maybe a month's wage for some of these people. And so she didn't have the money for the $20. Blessings didn't have the money for the $20, but Blessings knew a guy in the States. And Blessings said, he emailed him and said, "Hey, there's this lady who's really sick and she needs $20, and we're going to use it to get her to a hospital and it'll help her feel better." And the guy in the States said, you know, he kind of thought Blessings was like being an African. He thought like, "Oh, you're just after my money," or, you know, he didn't really understand. He had never seen extreme poverty before. He didn't understand how desperate the situation was. So he said no to sending over $20. 6 months later, that same guy who said no came on a mission trip with a group of people. This guy was leading a mission trip, and he found they were going on a tour through the village. Blessings was taking this group of people through the village. And they pass this lady, and she's sitting on the ground. She's like baking in the sun. She's just got sores all over her body. And everyone on the tour is like, "Oh my gosh, what's going on? What's happening here? Like, I've never seen anything like this before. Why isn't she being helped?" And Blessing said, "Oh, do you remember the lady who we asked $20 for 6 months ago? This is her. This is the lady who didn't get the $20. She never got to go to the hospital. She's just been here baking in the sun every single day for the last 6 months." And so they had this whole plan for how they were going to spend their mission trip, and they completely changed their plans. They said, "Okay, forget everything we were going to do. Our new goal is just to help this lady. We're going to buy her a mattress. We're going to take her to the hospital. We're going to get her all of the food and medicine she needs." And they spent the entire 2 weeks there just like taking care of this lady, like running her back and forth to the hospital and all this stuff. And they had done everything. And then when they were leaving, they even said, "All right, what can we leave with her? What are the things we can do for her just to leave with her, even though we're going back to America?" And so they left a bunch of stuff with her. They got back on the plane. They went to America. And a day after they left, she died. She passed away.
Wow.
And it's one of those stories that's horrific. And it's this little girl, Emily. When I lived in Malawi, I would go out to this village every single Friday, and I would play soccer with the kids out there. And every Friday, I saw this little girl, Emily, and I always was reminded, like, $20 was the difference between her being an orphan and not being an orphan. After her mom died, her abusive dad ran off, and Emily and her little brother, Chisoma, are now, like, orphans in Malawi. And I couldn't get that, like, out of my head. I was like, $20, there's got to be a way. Like, this is insane. Like, there's got to be a way to fix this problem, right? Like, anyone in America, if they knew that they could save someone's life, they would send that $20 over. Almost anyone in America, you know, the vast majority of people. And so, yeah, that was the type of, like, extreme poverty, like not being able to pay $20 to take care of yourself. So it's pretty bad. It's one of the poorest countries in the entire world.
Yeah, you had said it's the in 2015. You said is the 10 poorest countries.
Oh, it's the 10 poorest countries right now. In 2015, it was the poorest. If you go by GDP per capita, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure something like that would definitely turn on a light bulb inside, you know, and in your head, and you're like, you know, we have all this amazing technology in the United States, and
yeah.
And a lot of people – actually, you know what? I saw one of your videos, and one thing that you said was interesting was that these people live on a dollar a day or less than a dollar a day sometimes, and yet most people in the United States are in debt. And so basically – so in a sense, people in the United States are poorer than the people in Africa, but what's the difference? Like
much
higher standard of living, much higher wealth, but still, it's a strange situation, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's weird. Yeah, like having a negative amount of assets is like a weird thing. But yeah, I would much rather have a negative amount of assets in the state than, you know, grow up in a village in Malawi. Anyone would take that any day.
Yeah. To me, it's the difference between money or currency and wealth, right? And most people tend to think that money is wealth, right? But, you know, money is just the stuff that we transact in. But wealth is actually the technology, the luxuries that we all take for granted that make our lives comfortable, right? Cars and air conditioning and houses and shoes and clothes, right? Basic necessities that basically is what civilization is all about. And and so, you know, you just throw a bunch of money at a country, they might be wealthy or they might be rich, but they're not. The wealth is not there yet. The infrastructure, the housing, the technology, it's not there yet. And maybe over time it will develop, but that's the difference. And so, what you're doing is, you know, you're helping people who do have the money or the access or the means to make more money in a country that is quite wealthy and has, you know, a lot of infrastructure, and you can direct it towards the people who need it without having to go through these complex, intricate, you know, bureaucracies, governments, and also I guess private charities are quite bureaucratic also, would you say?
You know, it's hard to like paint a blanket statement because there's so many different types of charities and so many of them are doing different things. But I have no problem saying that there are a lot of charities that are either fraudulent or not using funds properly, and for the most part, not using funds efficiently.
Right.
I mean, the average, you know, anytime you give, but like, let's say there's a donor relations person that you're interacting with who's like telling you about the charity and why you should donate to it. 99% of the time, that donor's relations person has like lives in the States. Like they're not connected to the issues overseas that they're supposedly fighting for. So yeah, I think one of the benefits of donating through a platform like DonorSee is that you're giving you're giving just directly to the people who are most well connected to the actual issues. They're not detached, they're not sitting in an air conditioning room. They're the people who like are face to face with it every single day.
Right.
And for anyone who's like face to face seeing extreme poverty, that's a totally different. That's the only way to like truly understand it. There's no way to understand it by just like reading about it in a book or seeing a movie about it. It's just, it's like a different planet, you know? So, I think that's just one of the benefits is like that direct connection to the people who are affected by these issues.
So you have, in a few countries, what do you call them? Aid workers or are they volunteers or do they take a salary or how does it work?
So here's how it works. Basically, anyone on the app can just sign up and start using it to fundraise. So most like missionaries, some aid workers, what they have to do is they raise like personal support to go overseas. So they already have like a donor network. And so let's say you have someone in the Philippines who's like a missionary and they live over there. They're connected to all of these third world issues and they're able to like use the app to take pictures and fundraise through the app to provide money for the people that are near them. They like already have an existing donor network. And then what we do is we vet a certain number of the projects and we put them in our staff picks section. So anyone who's like a new donor who's looking for ways to give directly, we don't recommend giving to like anything on the app, but anything that you give through the staff picks section are things that we've personally vetted and like can nearly guarantee, all right, the money's going to go exactly where it explains in the description of this project.
Wait, you said you vet the ones through the staff picks, you said? And there are other ones that you don't?
Yeah, so anyone can post anywhere in the world. Like we want, like an emergency situation, someone needs to raise money for Hurricane Matthew or something like that.
Right.
We don't want to prevent that kind of thing from happening. We want money to get to people as soon as possible. But we also take the time, you know, there's a lot of situations that aren't like that. So what we do is we find certain projects and we vet them. Like we make sure that the money given to those projects is going to the right place. Mm-hmm. And we say DonorSee is like behind this. And so anything in the staff picks section is things that you can, like you can feel good about giving to these people because they have a relationship with DonorSee and they're going to use the money appropriately, like guaranteed.
Okay. So that would be the guarantee for like fraud or somebody just posted a picture from Google and.
Yeah. It's like a needy, like a poor starving kid. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. And Yeah. It's really an amazing thing. Like the way you described it, it's like putting money directly from your pocket to someone else's pocket.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was explaining it to a friend recently that it's peer to peer in the sense that, you know, I don't know if you made this comparison with it, but like Uber, Lyft, or Airbnb is peer to peer. Would you say this is an example of peer to peer charity?
Yeah, it definitely is. I think we describe it like that in some of our literature. And there was an article written about us on fee.org, fee.org.
Oh, nice.
And they called us the Uber for charity. So
nice.
That's like a name that's kind of getting picked up. Yeah.
The Uber for charity. Awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
So you were also in Haiti recently, right?
I got back about a week ago.
So how did that go? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It was rough. It was not like I was hoping. I mean, so there's two ways of saying it. It was good in terms of what we were able to accomplish. It was bad in terms of things like my personal safety and like how comfortable I felt while I was over there.
Mm.
So my goal when I was over there was to show people. I told them I'm going to go over to Haiti right after Hurricane Matthew, and I'm taking nothing but my iPhone and the DonorSee app.
Yeah.
And that's true. Like, I didn't really bring anything with me besides that, like a toothbrush or whatever. And I got over there, and what we did was we used the money that came through the app, about $8,000, to buy disaster relief kits for the people in Haiti who were most affected by Hurricane Matthew, the people of La Caille.
Wow.
And this is like a town right on the shores of Haiti. So it was like a 4-hour drive through dirt roads to get to this like remote town. And when we got there, it was like bulldozed, and it was just like complete devastation.
Hmm.
Like trees had fallen over. Buildings had been like reduced to rubble.
Hmm.
Some structures were still up, like amazingly, but like, yeah, it was just like wrecked. I don't know how this happened, but we booked our tickets a month in advance. And I, Greg Glyer, was in Haiti before any other major aid organization, like any other major aid charity that you can think of. I beat them booking my tickets a week in advance. I still can't like imagine how that happened. But we using the DonorSee app, we used that $8,000 to make 300 disaster relief kits, and we distributed them to the people of La Caille. And somehow, yeah, so it was like a really meaningful thing. But also, I think the other thing that happened that was just kind of, it was very unsafe. And there were like a few riots, like while we were driving out there, there were a few riots that broke out, a few people who were like lighting tires on fire in protest, and
Ooh.
A few like fights between military guys and civilians. And we were like passing through this stuff. And because of that, I actually ended up leaving 2 days early.
Mm.
But the all of the like relief supplies and stuff like still got out to all the people.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to like remove myself from the situation as a basically as a person, as a white person who would be more of a target
than
someone who like fits in the country,
right,
you know.
Right.
So it was interesting. It was really good. It was really nice to see like what was possible with the app.
Mm-hmm.
But also kind of scary, to be honest.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, $8,000, I'm sure that helped a lot. So can you talk a little bit about what your knowledge is in foreign aid to these countries in Malawi and Haiti?
Yeah. So in Haiti, back in 2010, right after the earthquake happened, there was $13 billion that was sent over to Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
After the earthquake. And these are organizations like the Clinton Foundation. You know, that's like all over your Facebook feed right now.
Right.
And then there's like the Red Cross, and I don't know no one knows specifics, right? It's really easy to just like be fraudulent. It's really easy to like not be transparent with how money gets spent.
Mm.
But the money was not spent well. Like the money, even if you talk to the people in Haiti, the people on the ground in Haiti, they said the money didn't get to us. And in fact, the money actually, was, like, it hurt the country. Like, it was invested so poorly that it actually caused more harm to the country than good.
Wow.
That's my example in Haiti. Like, if you gave money back in 2010, I'm sorry, but your donation was most likely wasted. And if you gave money to Hurricane Matthew most recently, there's a chance it was used well, but when I was over there, I didn't see it. You know, I don't know, like, what's going on. I don't know how these billions of dollars are being wasted, but they are. And all you have to do is ask an actual Haitian about that. You know, an actual Haitian who's like in a village or who is affected by the hurricane, who lost a family member, ask them, did you get to see any of this disaster relief money? When your house was bulldozed over, did they build you a new house or did they keep it in their pockets, you know?
Right.
That's Haiti. In Malawi, I lived there from 2013 to 2016. And let's see, at the end of 2013, I believe, or maybe it was 2014. In 2014, I'm sorry, there was this huge government scandal called Cashgate. And basically, it was found out that the majority of foreign aid that was coming into the country was just being pocketed by government officials, by almost all of the government officials. And so it wasn't like a few like people on the side. This was like a really entrenched thing in the government.
Mm.
And people were very upset. There was, I actually, on one of my podcasts, I interviewed a guy who was shot in the face 3 times because he was the one who exposed Cashgate.
Mm.
So, this was like a really bad situation. And I think what makes it so unbelievable is that the money was supposed to go to things like the hospital or providing food for hungry people in these like remote villages during the hungry season.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's who they were stealing from. They were stealing money from like the neediest people in the entire world and they're keeping it for themselves. So yeah, not a fan of foreign aid.
so you're saying the government that is the people, that represents the people, that supposedly the people, the people, the people control their government, right?
And
the way people say we. What do you mean? It's not the state and us. We are the state. We are the government.
Yeah.
So as Malawi, are you the government?
And Malawi is a democratic nation. Like, they elect a president every year. Everyone's an elected official. Mm-hmm. That's kind of similar to the states. It's a 2 or 3 party system. And when the majority of parties are corrupt, or when the winning party is corrupt, that's just what they're stuck with, you know?
Yeah, from my experience with foreign aid or learning about foreign aid is that's generally the game plan is, you know, billions of dollars goes overseas apparently to help, you know, the poverty-stricken remote villages, but it actually surprisingly or accidentally ends up in the hands of wealthy politicians and warlords.
Yeah, it accidentally ends up in their hands.
Strengthens their military and their control, and so it's an amazing thing, you know, the state. But you know, interesting talking about the state is that after you were on Tom Woods, you had a lot of an influx of volunteers and anarchists flock to your to support you, right? To friend you on Facebook, and so can you
follow me on Twitter and all that stuff. Yeah, a lot of them.
Yeah, and I heard that like some of the Tom Woods supporting listeners. They helped to build a woman a house for $800, right? Is that true?
Yeah. So here's what happened. The day the Tom Woods show came out, the podcast came out, in the following days, my phone was like constantly buzzing with new people signing up, new donations being given.
Ooh,
and I like literally I was, if you talk to the people I was around during those couple of days, it was like I was like trying to find enough projects to get onto the site to get funded because they were getting funded too fast.
Wow, that's a problem.
It was really cool. And then there was one house in particular. There were actually like 3 houses that got funded during those few days and a bunch of other cool stuff that happened.
Right.
But there was one house in particular that I think Tom Woods like promoted and all the Tom Woods listeners like got together and funded this one house in Malawi. It's just like a cool thing. It was like 15 or 20 people came together, funded. It was $800 to build this widow a house in Malawi, like just this unbelievably small amount to build someone a house.
Mm.
And they all came together, built her house. And right now, like anyone who donated, the cool thing about the app is you get picture and video updates of your donation.
Mm-hmm.
So every few days, the people who donated to that house, they're getting like little video updates of like the construction of the house. Like today the foundation's being laid and today the walls are going up and the roof is being put on and they're getting like video and photographic pictures of the progress of this happening. And it's like a cool thing. Like this community came together, donated a house, and now they all get to see like what their money did. Like that's the cool thing about DonorSee is in the past when you would give money, you get like a thank you email. Now you give money and you get to actually see how your money is making an impact. It's like, It should have been invented like 20 years ago. I don't know why it's just invented now.
See, we needed a Gret Glider 20 years ago, but we're happy that we finally got a Gret Glider. And nevertheless, oh, right? Yeah, it's like when you meet somebody and you're like, you're such a fit with that person. And you're like, mm-hmm. Why haven't I met you, you know, years ago? You're like, well, let's just be happy that we met, you know? let's just be happy that this came about, you know? But to me, it demonstrates the awesome power of the internet, you know, that it can bring people together. You know, communication is such an amazing thing. I guess you can have more insight into this, or I've heard a lot of African countries which have very little infrastructure, but they have very powerful cell phone networks. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them do have smartphones. Is that true?
Yeah, it's kind of true. So a lot of the area of the country has smartphone coverage. So like I can go out into a village with my iPhone and like FaceTime my mom, or I can like Skype my friends or whatever. It's like crazy. I can like have the phone out in front of me, FaceTime my mom, give her a little tour of the village, you know? And that's like how we get these videos done with DonorSee.
Right.
Like these aid workers, like my friend Jenna, she is building a house for a widow with like a few kids. And actually, I think the widow takes care of like 7 kids. And so, it's like this, you know, sad situation that we get to like make her life a little bit better. And Jenna just takes her iPhone 5 out into the village, takes some video and uploads it on the DonorSee right from there. And the 20 or 25 people who donate to that house, they get that update in real time, like seconds after she took the video. Smartphone use is like totally available there, but at the same time, it's not like all the villagers have a smartphone, you know, like there's maybe like one person in a village who has a dumb phone and they can use that phone to communicate with other villages or people in the city.
Right.
But the majority of people who live in these like really rural villages, the majority of them don't have a cell phone yet. I wouldn't be surprised if the internet, if the entire planet gets Wi-Fi before they get clean water. I would not be surprised if that happens.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That's the power of the internet and what, you know, the demand for, you know, cat videos and, yeah, that's more
and
important.
Yeah.
And, that kind of stuff, ultimate fails. but you know, another thing that it really brings to mind for me is how much people want to give, right? So as an anarchist and a volunteer, when I talk to people about these ideas and the not only how the state is unnecessary, but actually how the state harms people. And a lot of people ask me, well, one common thing is, what about the poor? Who's going to take care of the poor? No welfare state, no foreign aid. Who's going to take care of the poor? Who's going to give them food and housing? And to me, what it demonstrates is that people want to give, right? Mm-hmm. Because every person that I talk to and they ask me that, I just tell them, you just asked me that. You weren't the only one. Many other people asked me that. So obviously there's a demand, even if there was no state forcing you through the welfare state to donate. And by the way, forced donation, it's an oxymoron. It's called theft, right? You can't force somebody to donate. It's just called a theft, right? Because if you want, donation is a voluntary act, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of people that really want to help, and they have the means to help. They just don't know how, right? And so you come along and you develop this app, which gives them real opportunity and the mechanism to do so, and people jump on it. All it needs to happen is to spread the idea. That's all that needs to happen. You know, the internet takes care of everything else.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting is with, like, the people want to give, and a big reason for why they don't give is because they don't trust, like, giant institutions to use their money well. So they're like, well, how are we going to help the poor? Well, it's like, the poor, there's a lot of poor who are not being helped right now, and it's the government's fault, you know? So, why don't we explore these other solutions? Like, what I'm doing, and lots of people are doing amazing things as well.
You know, and also reminds me, I don't know if you've heard this this company, they're like a shoe company, and this guy says that if you buy a pair of his shoes, he'll give a pair of shoes to somebody in Africa.
Have
you
heard? Yeah, Tom's.
Oh, okay, you have heard.
I'm very familiar, yeah.
So what do you know about that? Because I have my opinions. I'm just curious, what do you think about that?
You want my uncensored opinions on that? Okay. So I'll tell you, I lived in Malawi for 3 years, you know, remote parts of Africa. I have seen a warehouse full of Tom's shoes in Malawi that have not been distributed. They're just sitting in a warehouse somewhere. And I mean, wow. We're talking like thousands of pairs of shoes. They're not like a Tom's shoe warehouse. It's like Tom's shoes came and dumped these shoes on this other organization, and the other organization like doesn't know what to do with all the shoes. So they're just like hanging on to them in the garage or in the warehouse.
Oh my God.
And so the big criticism with Tom, I have mixed opinions. On the one hand, I love that people are like becoming more socially aware and like, you know, people care that there are people without shoes in the rest of the world.
Right.
You know, that's a cool thing.
Right,
and
right.
It's like this thing that blew, you know, Tom's shoes that blew up, they, you know, it's, you know, they probably blew up faster than they knew they what to do with it. And now they're like struggling to like find people to distribute shoes. Well, you know, it's just a whole thing. It's hard to do charity well. It's hard to do poverty alleviation well. But, you know, one of the criticisms that they get a lot, and it's a fair criticism, is that if you go into a new community and you blanket that community with pairs of shoes, okay, everyone has shoes, but then you've also, the guy, the shoemaker in that local village, that guy's out of a job.
Exactly.
He's got no income anymore. You've just, like, ruined his livelihood. He's got to go do something else. And so, but, like, to bring back, like, what we did with when we went down to Haiti, the 300 disaster relief kits, we bought all of them in Haiti. We bought every single supply in the country of Haiti so that we were both stimulating the local economy and providing relief to the people instead of buying the supplies in America and then dropping them in Haiti, because that's going to cause problems too.
Yeah. So one thing that that I really like what you guys are doing is you guys are over there, you're on the ground, and you're talking to these people, and you're like, you ask them, what do you need? Right? Because it's like this guy, Tom, he's like, all right, I'm just going to send shoes over there. blanket the place with shoes. And you guys are like, forget the shoes. What do you need? Tell me what you need, because I don't know what everybody needs. You know, everybody's an individual. Everybody's got individual needs and desires and wants. Mm-hmm. So tell me what you need, and we're going to get the money, and you can buy that. You know.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there's lots of places that need clean water, or they need better hygiene or whatever. Like, shoes are probably a pretty low priority. I mean, living in Malawi, there's a lot of people who are shoeless. Like, they just walk around without shoes.
Right.
But none of them feel like that's a problem.
Right.
You know, that's just, like, what they're used to. They just they just have, like, really calloused feet, and they just – that's just what their life is like. But, like, they do get hungry, and they do get sick from not having good water, you know, and that's something that does affect their lives and that they do, which is better. So –
Yeah. And another thing it reminds me of is actually Tom Woods. He mentioned another scholar. He kind of, I guess, went down to South America, and he went to some factory where, you know, a lot of people in the United States would say, you know, they're being exploited. It's a sweatshop. You know, they're paying them such low wages. Isn't that horrible? And or they're paying them, let's say they're making them work long hours and no vacations and everything like that. And so they went down there. And they asked the people, because all the people in the United States are like, well, you got to give them vacations, you got to give them longer break times, bigger lunches, you got to give them longer maternity leaves. And the guy went down there and he asked a bunch of the employees down there, do you want vacation? Do you want more vacation? Do you want more breaks? Do you want you know, let's say a nicer environment, air conditioning, you know, or because if I give you all that, I'm going to have to pay you less.
Yeah.
Or would you rather work in the environment that you're working in now and get more money? And can you guess what they chose?
Oh, yeah, more money.
Right, exactly. So basically the idea is that you don't know what's in the mind of the individual, right? Mm-hmm. You're assuming you know what they want, and you can't do that, right? So you basically, people just want the money, and they buy whatever they think is important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you try to micromanage and assume what people want, you're becoming the little central planner, you know, the little dictator in other people's lives. And it's just like what happens with Tom's shoes. The only result is inefficiency and waste.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about people complaining that the sweatshop kids don't have vacation days, I promise you that the only people who complain about that are people who have never spent like a significant amount of time in these other countries.
Right.
Because if you talk to these people, you know, like, these people, like, this is a good situation for them. It's not, you know, it's not ideal, Mm-hmm. Obviously, like, it'd be nice for them to get a get paid vacation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they actually have a job. They have what they call consistent work,
right.
Which is not like, there's a lot of people in these countries who don't have that. They like find piecework. They find like little jobs to do here and there. And it's very like some weeks they go without food.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to have like a consistent place where they can get a job and they know that they'll be able to put food on the table, that's like a big blessing to a lot of these people. That's like very meaningful to a lot of these people.
Yeah, there's a video talking about this by Learn Liberty. I don't know if you know that YouTube channel, Learn Liberty. They post a lot of awesome videos, but one of them they posted a while ago, which is it's like three ways that sweatshops improve poverty-stricken countries or help people to lift them out of poverty. And it's such a confusing thing because even the term sweatshop, it sounds so evil, you know, it's like
child labor and things like that.
Yeah, it sounds like such an evil thing. But when in fact that's really the first step to lifting a country out of poverty is basically free trade. You know, you allow businesses to come in and build up the infrastructure and get people who basically have very, very basic skills, and you teach them new skills, and that's the entry level. Like, it's the same thing like, you know, a kid starting off working in McDonald's or Taco Bell, you know, that's not a lifelong career. It's a stepping stone. It's an entry level job, right? In the sense that these are entry level jobs that these people can gain skills and then hopefully go on to bigger and better jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's, go ahead.
Well, it's because it's like a generational problem, right? Like, this is like the first step, and like these, you can't just take a country out of poverty overnight. Like, it takes decades and decades,
exactly,
and
right.
even longer in a lot of times. So, the sweatshop is kind of like a phase one, you know,
right.
and it's improvements can be made from there. But like, yeah, people demanding, I've said enough about that.
No problem. So let me ask you, what is your view on the welfare state?
I don't know. Like, I think I want to say, like, I'm really conflicted. On the one hand, it seems like most rational to say that, like, get rid of it. Like, poverty should be, like, capitalism is the ship that is the tide that raises all ships.
Right.
I want to like say that. And on the other hand, it just seems like, you know, maybe it would be helpful. Maybe, I don't know. I get my heart all like caught up in it. You know, I put myself in the position of like a single mom who's like taking care of three kids. And I want to be like, how, you know, what about her? And it's just hard for me. It's hard for me to condemn something when I know like it is genuinely helping a handful of people, and I don't want to take that away from them. So I'm all over the map.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a complex. Sorry, it's a complex question. it's got multi layers, and like we can do a whole episode on just the welfare state and how, you know, what incentives that brings about for people who are in poverty. And the other thing that actually Tom Woods often likes to say, which I really like, and I now say, is that, you know, people, one of the questions people ask is, why is there poverty in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an inaccurate question, because poverty is the default state of man, right? We were all born in poverty, or, you know, we came from poverty like centuries ago in terms of the way that most of humanity used to live, you know, centuries ago. Is nothing like the way what we consider poor people in the United States live.
Oh, for
today,
sure.
You know.
Yeah.
So so the level of poverty has really improved significantly, but there will always be people in abject poverty for one reason or another. But the trend is it is improving, and we should recognize that. And why is it improving? And basically, it's when people are allowed to trade, you know, and transact freely without intervention, without taxation, without regulation. You know, businesses develop and they reinvest. They, you know, they have profits and they reinvest and they develop their manufacturing, their infrastructure, they build, and, you know, people's salaries go farther. They can purchase more because, you know, the more efficient the technology becomes, the cheaper the cost, and so people can buy more, right? The wealth increases. You know, this is the difference between wealth and money. And so, like you said, it's a multi-generational thing for a country to come out of poverty, right? You have to just allow them. You give them the freedom, and which is exactly why I am an anarchist and a volunteer, is because the state is the primary hindrance. It's the parasite on the back of the host, of the industrious people that are actually doing the work. The entrepreneurs, you know, the innovators, the creators, people like you who are actually creating things of value that make people's lives better without relying on taxation or, as most volunteers would say, theft.
And I think another thing to point out is the welfare state is strictly a first world phenomenon, right? Malawi being a really, you know, one of the poorest countries on earth,
right?
They can't walk down, you know, to the senator's office and sign up for welfare. They just can't do that. So somehow that they have to survive without reliance on the government. Almost every single person in that country. So in their case, what they do is they become very community and relationship oriented. So whenever they get into a situation where they're in trouble, they work with the people around them. And on the one hand, that keeps everyone alive. On the other hand, it kind of keeps everyone in poverty too, because there's all of these new social pressures to not save money. And instead of saving money, any excess money that you have to give to the poorest people in your community. That's just the expectation.
Right.
And so the most successful, like, smart people who are the best at wealth creation, they end up leaving the community and going to a place without these social pressures and with more private property rights.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah. So it's kind of like a brain drain of people who are successful. They actually leave to more
better opportunities.
Wealthier countries. That's interesting. And in that way, the poverty is not corrected. Wow. So definitely, you know, anything to me that can develop as a business, because the way people look at this, I don't know if what you would call your, no, well, you're not a business, you're a charity, I guess, right?
Technically, we're a for-profit, actually.
You are, okay.
Yeah, because we're a website, and people can sign up to use the platform, but really all we do is we shuffle money in the right direction. So we're trying to, make enough money to sustain ourselves through.
So how do people how do you cover your basic costs? I guess like web hosting.
We're not even close to doing that. But like Kickstarter and GoFundMe, they both take like a 5% fee.
Nice.
What we do is we take a 4% fee from every transaction that goes through the app, and that helps us cover our costs. And someday I'd like to lower that if possible, but we're just so far from covering our costs at the moment that we're gonna keep it at 4%.
Right.
Yeah.
So what I was gonna say is you know, people tend to vilify profit, right? You know, they say if it's profitable, it must be evil. Somebody's benefiting. Somebody's exploiting you, right? But but really, what profit is, it's just a signal. It's a signal that what you're doing is an efficient use of resources, and people like it, and they're buying your product or your service. And so that's an incentive to further maybe innovate and improve your product or service and develop it further, you know. And so basically when a business is creating profit, they're creating value, they're lifting people's lives, they're improving people's lives. And when you have, you know, freedom to transact, freedom to do business as you see fit, you know, that's really the beginning of true civilization, right? And so that's why I say, you know, it's interesting, like in a country as poor as many African countries, you know, you have the people who live in abject poverty, and then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the people, the rulers in the government that get all that foreign aid. And so you're like, well, how are these two people, you know, how is these two groups getting along? Like, how does that happen? And they just, I don't know, they just accept it. I don't know. I mean, which is one, you know, I see a lot of groups on Facebook, like volunteers in Pakistan, volunteers in Japan, volunteers all over the world, in Thailand, and Bangladesh. And it's a really encouraging thing to see, because it just shows me that these principles are truly universal, you know, regardless of where you live. And that, it's just very, very satisfying.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I really think that, you know, this kind of thing, and, you know, peer-to-peer decentralized platforms and networks is really what's going to, is going to, you know, raise the standard of living for a lot of people. And, you know, as an anarchist and a voluntarist, I would say, you know, releasing the grip of the state and the belief in authority, you know, because basically, you know, I would say anyway that the state is just a state of mind, you know. It's fundamentally, the state really doesn't exist. It's just men and women with guns forcing you to pay them, right? And so basically, it's a failed business model, right? Because if what the state is doing is actually helping people and people actually want it, then they wouldn't need to force people with guns and by the threat of imprisonment, right? Because people would want to voluntarily fund it, and then that would no longer be a state. That would be a business.
Yes, we're going into a new age. I'm curious to get what are your predictions on whether or not we'll get, or do you think we're going more and more into more government regulations or less of it?
I think well, of course, the state is probably trying to clamp down, and you know, there's, you know, the United States anyway, there's been a lot of you know, they're trying to increase the grip on the industrious, but I think the real savior for mankind is the internet, is the ability for people to communicate and connect all over the world with other people, and it breaks down borders, it renders nation states obsolete, you know, because who cares if you know, CNN and NBC and the president tells you to hate people in the Middle East, you know, if you can get on Skype or you can get on Facebook and you can talk to these people directly. And you like ask them, like, do you want to blow up? You want to blow up us, you know, the United States or any cities over here? And they're like, no, I just want to get to work. You know, I want to feed my kids. I want to, you know, make sure they get a good education. Okay, good. That's what I thought. So you know, I think that all that's needed to improve the world is to expand the reach of the internet. It's just to connect people online, right? It's a global community, you know. That's what the internet has done. It has unified people all over the world in real time, and in that way has rendered nation states obsolete. And I think slowly they will collapse like the dinosaur institutions that they are, and people will realize that, wait a minute, why do we need to be forced to fund things against our will? Why don't we just do it voluntarily, the things that we actually want to? And why do we need these rulers telling us, you know, that we should hate these people, we got to go to war with these people, you know, and you know, all the race baiting and all that, you know, so people are just going to recognize that, no, these people, they're not serving us, they're not representing us, these people, they're just high class thieves and you know, and criminals, basically. You know, I often call them mass murderers, but you can't really say that because they didn't commit the murder themselves. It's more actually, you know, they're the order givers, right? They're not the order followers. So
yeah, the head of the mob.
The head of the mob, right. So yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's interesting. I am curious to see how everything plays out because it does seem like there's all this technology that's being invented that's giving people more freedom than they've ever had before.
It's a beautiful
thing. At the same time, like, the government is trending towards more regulation. So there's like this tension. And yeah, I don't know which way it's going to go.
You know, I on this podcast, my message is peaceful anarchism, right? So the idea of anarchy, when you say that to the common person, they have, you know, certain images of, like, you know, explosions and a Molotov cocktail and maybe assassinations of, like, you know, heads of state and you know, violent acts like that. And it's not like that at all. You know, the anarchy, the word itself, etymologically speaking, is just you know, no rulers. That's it. Just no rulers. And then the idea of voluntarism goes a little bit further in the philosophical realm of self-ownership, property rights, and non-aggression. And just outlining, you know, the universal laws of morality that everybody basically understands, who considers themselves to be a decent human being. But for some reason, when agents of the state do the very, you know, things that we would consider a crime, but they do them, and they call it taxation, they call it the war on drugs, they call it the war on terror, they call it, you know, getting arrested, getting kidnapped, they call it all these euphemisms,
or they call it, you know, it's not spying, it's surveillance, you know. You know, all of a
sudden. Very clever.
Yeah, there's a lot of political euphemisms. Like, have you read the book 1984?
George Orwell, a long time ago. That was like a school, high school thing.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that they have people read it in high school. Double speak, right? So, you know, you say one thing and you mean an exact opposite, right? Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. War is peace, right? So taxation, it's not theft, it's taxation, right? You know? And people are like, well, you got to pay your taxes. No, it's not about paying taxes because they just take your taxes. I mean, when you go to a job, you know, they didn't ask you, you know, would you like to donate to the welfare state, to the, you know, to this and that? They just take it and you're left with whatever's left. So you don't pay taxes. They take taxes. So I'm incredibly optimistic regarding the future. I think I think that all that's needed to bring about a fundamental shift of paradigm is the spread of ideas such as what you do. And you know, I focus on peaceful parenting, unschooling, homeschooling, not obeying regulations. And you know, it sounds like, oh, that sounds so violent. No, you can like having a lemonade stand in your front yard is illegal if you don't have the proper permits, right? But again, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. You're not hurting anybody. You know, like, raw milk is illegal. You know, lemonade stand is illegal. driving without a license plate is illegal. Or driving with your left blinker out is illegal. Driving without your seatbelt is illegal, right? And these are not crimes. They're what you call nonviolent or victimless crimes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the only true crimes are crimes with a victim, right? Mm-hmm. And if there's no clear victim, there is no crime. So that's the idea. What do you think? That's the idea of voluntarism.
Yeah. I'm always torn between, like, yeah, that makes so much sense. And then also, like, oh, but I just care. I don't know. Like, you know, there's some people where it's not the best option for them, like, in the moment. Like, over time, maybe it will be. But then I'm like, oh, but it'll screw these certain people over. So, I have all these conflicting emotions about it.
So yeah, let me give you an example of something that somebody would say to me. Like, if I say that the welfare state destroys people's incentive to improve themselves and condemns them to a permanent underclass in the same way as when you go to a park and you see the sign, it says don't feed the birds, because if you do so, they will get dependent on you and they will lose the ability to feed themselves, right? Or to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
Right? So this is how the same thing with the welfare state, how it condemns people to a permanent state of poverty or handouts, because they give them all these gifts and handouts, and then once they start to have a job and take care of themselves, all these handouts get taken away and they feel that pain and it's very uncomfortable. So it's very difficult and the incentives are against them. So basically when I talk to people about that, about the welfare state, they're like, well, who's going to take care of the poor? And I can mention you, and they're like, well, you know, he's one guy. You know, what about someone else? What about this person? And they make up some hypothetical. But the difference is, like, you know, you're actually you see a problem and you're actually doing something about it. You didn't say, you know, I'm one guy. What can I do to change the world? I can't do anything. So why even try? No, you're actually changing. And the thing is, you can't get overwhelmed, right? You know, I tell people it's just one mind at a time. You talk to one people at a time. You help one person at a time. And you do make a difference.
The reason people feel like they can't make a difference is because whenever they give, they're giving to like some giant vat.
Right.
And then they get like they're like, hey, your donation made an impact. Right. Thank you for giving. But like when you give and you see bricks being put on top of other bricks and people moving into a house.
Oh, beautiful.
Then you actually, then it's like, oh, wow, I do make an impact. You can make an impact. Like that, there's like such a disconnect right now that I hope it's fixed.
Yeah. So I think
I think, you know, the idea of voluntarism, you are a voluntarist in action. If not, even if you don't understand it philosophically, you are a voluntarist in action, you know?
Yeah.
You did not appeal to the state, you did not see a problem and then write a petition or call your congressman or, you know, go out and lobby Capitol Hill.
Yeah, no, it'd be a complete waste of my time.
right. So you are truly an example of voluntarist in action, and all that's left is for you to study it a bit more and learn about the intricacies, and it's really... to me, it really has changed my life and the way I view the world, and it's like, you know, as a result of learning about this stuff, I no longer view people as like Americans, French people, German people, Haitians, Malawian. You know, I don't view people that we're just people. We're just human beings trying to, you know, trying to get ahead, trying to feed our kids, trying to put food on the table, trying to give them an education and give them good moral code and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at it like that, like, why would you hate this group of people just because they look different or they act different or they have a different religion? There's no reason to, you know?
Yeah. As when I was in a senior in college, it was in 2012, there were two things that were really popular that year. So that was like an election year. Mm-hmm. And one of the third party candidates was Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And then, so he became like a lot of guys and girls my age, like really liked Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And at the same time, Kony 2012 also came out that same year, which is like the Invisible Children video that went completely viral, like 200 million views or whatever.
Yeah.
About helping the child soldiers in Uganda.
Mm.
And it was just funny because it seemed like a lot of the same people both supported Ron Paul and the Invisible Children, Kony 2012, which is a complete contradiction because Kony 2012 was like, hey, we're going to like write to all of our senators and get the word out to as many people as possible so that Obama will sign a petition to send troops into Uganda to stop this from happening.
Right.
And guess what? They didn't stop anything. Like, you know, they're still out there. They're still child soldiers.
Right.
Kony is still at large.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how these waves come.
Yeah, one interesting phenomenon is, you know, a lot of people say, well, the only way to make change in the world is to vote.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get to the voting booth.
Oh, yeah, right,
you
for
get,
sure.
Get to the voting booth, and you got to press that button, and that's how you make change, right? And the funny thing is, you know, I don't know, let's say 40% of the population vote, or 30% even, you know, and they vote. They're like, I want this done. All right, let's vote for it. And so they're voting to have politicians force them and other people to fund them, which is kind of a strange thing. You're voting for somebody to force you to fund something, right? That's very strange. But the other idea is that if so many millions of people voluntarily went to the ballot box to vote for something, why didn't they just do it themselves? Why didn't they just why didn't you just donate, use the money, and send it? Why do you have to enable an organization whose only means of getting things done is through violence and threats of violence and imprisonment and guns? That's the only way they get things done. The state does not produce anything, right? One of the famous Nietzsche quotes is, you know, the state is a cold monster, and everything the state says is a lie, and everything the state has is stolen, right? Mm. So the state is not an institution that creates anything, right? It's just like a highway thief. It's a highway robber. The only difference is the highway thief steals from you, and then he leaves, right? Whereas the state follows you and steals from you.
Repeatedly, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So please let everyone know how they can find you. You know, reiterate your contact information.
Yeah, so anyone can reach out to me on Twitter. So that would be at Greg Glyer, GRETGLYER. And if you want to talk to me about DonorSee, you can also just email me, gretz@donorsee.com. And I check that very regularly, very responsive. And just send me a Facebook friend request too. That's fine.
Yeah. He wants more volunteer anarchist friends. Definitely. Please. he doesn't have enough. I don't have enough either. You know, I'm always looking for more. You can never have enough volunteer friends. But one thing I like to ask my guests before I let them go is, what is your favorite quote of all time?
Mm. Oh, man, on the spot. I think, so this is very meaningful to me as someone, like, I'm a Christian, and growing up, I was kind of like surrounded with like a lot of high-minded intellectual theological types, and I was always like, you know, everyone's like head is in the clouds sometimes, And there's this Bible verse, James 1:27, that goes, pure religion that is undefiled is this, to take care of orphans and widows in distress. And that was like a breath of fresh air for me, because for the first time, instead of like thinking about things, I have something in front of me where I can do, okay, taking care of orphans and widows. And so, yeah, if you're in a place in your life where you're like, you know, I've got all these thoughts that, you know, I spend so much time, you know, being an armchair critic or thinking about things, but you want something to do, you know, there are things you can do. There are ways that you can be genuinely contribute to society. And I think that's like a very practical way you can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what that brings to mind to me is how one of the beautiful things about voluntarists and anarchists is that when there's a problem in the mm-hmm. world, they don't say somebody else is going to solve it, right? Mm-hmm. They don't say, you know, let's just elect this politician and he'll solve it. Mm-hmm. You know, they take it into their own hands. Like you asked me before we started talking about the police, and most voluntarists and anarchists are well armed and skilled in firearms mm-hmm. and self-defense. Because yeah. they understand that, I mean, number one, if you call the police, most likely your dog's going to get shot. And if you're lucky, yeah. you won't get shot. So, right. so you know, it's a very dangerous thing now to call the police for anything. But really, they don't have any kind of incentive to help. You know, they're like the only ones, you know, they're the only, supposedly they're there for protection, but really they're mm-hmm. law enforcement agents, right? But this is why a lot of voluntarists and anarchists understand that, you know, sometimes you have to be knowledgeable in taking care of yourself and your family. And also, I don't know if you heard about this other app called Cell 411. Have you heard about that?
Mm-hmm.
Virgil Vaduva. I'll send you that that interview. I interviewed him as well. He made an app basically that is basically the alternative to 911.
Mm.
And basically, so it's setting up a network of people. So everybody downloads this app on their
phone.
Oh, interesting. And then when you
okay.
have a problem, you know, you put all your information in there. So when you have a problem, you press a button and it actually gives you many options, you know, like I'm getting robbed or a police officer is harassing me or whatever. There's a fire at my home or, you know, some kind yeah. of medical emergency, let's say. And immediately people in your vicinity get this notification. They can come and help you very quickly.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right?
That's interesting.
Yeah, because there's a saying, when seconds matter, the police are minutes away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I can already tell you, like, I know that some people will be critical of that app because they'll be like, well, you know, they're not trained or whatever, but it's like, the thing that people aren't willing to admit, because, you know, I get criticism for my app, like, you're using aid workers instead of people who are, you know, trained professionals, but the thing that seems to not get mentioned is the trained professionals are often doing like a terrible job of actually helping.
Mm,
so like,
really?
I think, yeah. And oh yeah. And plenty of cases. So I think like, diversifying and, like what your friend is doing with self-aware, like that's really interesting. Like maybe there are better ways of getting help to people. I think that's super interesting. I love like experiments like that. I think that's really cool.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's really amazing, and basically it's just an example of basically breaking the monopoly on security and protection, right? That
yeah.
what the police do, they're supposed to do security and protection, and they're saying, you know, just like what you're doing, decentralizing the whole idea and just making it peer to peer, and how much more awesome it becomes because it's so much more responsive and using smartphone technology. It's just like, it's amazing. Again, using the power of the internet to help people. And mm-hmm. and there's so many ways to do that. And it's just so amazing to see. This is why I'm excited about the future, because I see more and more examples of people creating really powerful technology to solve real problems like what you're
yeah.
doing, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they're just, yeah.
It's neat, yeah.
It's boundless, you know. The possibilities are boundless, and so I'm really optimistic and hopeful for the future. And so I'm just doing what I can to spread information, educate people about these concepts, and slowly I think you know through what you're doing as well, the world will improve.
Well, yeah, thank you for that. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, no problem. Really appreciate it. And I definitely want to hear you know updates about what you're doing and how it grows.
Definitely.
You know,
yeah.
Maybe we'll have you on again to hear mm-hmm. more about in the future. So awesome conversation. So if anybody wants to help me out, you can do so through
Patreon, PayPal, or Bitcoin. Links are below. That's patreon.com/peacefulanarchism to help me out. A dollar show is all I ask. I enjoy interviewing fascinating people like Gret here, and I would love to do more of it. And but as we know in economics, there's always opportunity cost to everything we do, right? You know, free time is not necessarily free. It always comes at a cost, right, to something else you could have been doing. So if you find value, please reciprocate value for value to help me do more of this amazing stuff that I love to do. So, yeah, thanks a lot, Gret, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
So everybody, please check him out, and you know, check his app and his go to his website, and you know, make some real change in the world. So this is Peace Wanarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network, and theconsciousresistance.com, and theseedsofliberty.com. Wishing everyone have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT no government license. Cell 411 because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at GetCell411.com. That's GetCell411.com.